Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
As 2018 draws to a close, the plaudits keep coming for author Rebecca Mackay. Her novel, The Great Believers, was one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year, one of the Washington Post's 50 notable books, and a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction, though it's very much based in fact. It's set in 1985 Chicago. The AIDS crisis is rocking the gay community, which is caring for the dying, mourning the dead, trying to decide whether to take a test that just came out for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and figuring out who to trust. The disease was almost always fatal and was primarily transmitted sexually. The novel also braids in a modern-day storyline. Fiona, whose brother died in 1985, is confronting the effect that's had on her for decades. So, Rebecca Mackay would have been 7 in the mid-80s. How does she get this all so pitch-perfect? How did she know a big concern at the time was pets left behind by the fallen, or that a Chicago hospital ward turned into a loving community? Well, for one thing, she wrote parts of the book in what used to be that ward, feeling the ghosts around her. She also finds footage of the AIDS group ACT UP protesting, read about the work of local ACT UP leader Danny Sotomayor. And as we found out when we spoke with Rebecca Mackay last June, setting the novel in Chicago became an imperative.
I'm from Chicago, and before I even knew the direction the book was really going to take, I wanted to write a Chicago novel. But as I started my research, I was kind of horrified by how little there was out there about the AIDS crisis in Chicago in specific. Even looking at some of the big, noteworthy nonfiction books about AIDS, Chicago's not even in the index. Mm. And this is the third biggest city in America.
Well, and you started talking to people and finding out what impact the disease had. And I just love it that for you, a lot of this was revelation. How did you do this? You get the young men who died with no will. Sometimes their families wouldn't let their friends even come to funerals. People are petrified of their blood. How'd you get all of this?
Part of my research was primary sources because there weren't books out there. I was going into the library and looking at back issues of gay weeklies from the 80s. But the other side of it was that I was seeking out people. And everyone I talked to, I asked them at the end, who should I talk to next? Mm. Until I was talking to doctors, nurses, survivors, of course, journalists, historians, lawyers, activists, and eventually found, you know, people who'd been diagnosed with AIDS or with HIV, rather, quite early on and were still with us. Mm. Often people who did not expect to be with us. So their perspective on things was really interesting to me.
Sure, because the cocktail came out that could very much prolong life. But, you know, your book is set before that.
Exactly.
You also, I understand, found a 1990 Chicago Reader article about the big ACT UP protest, which is it was in front of the Cook County building. You have your characters participating in this protest. People can go to YouTube and they can see some of it. People laying down on the ground, getting harshly arrested by the police. How were you informed by that?
I became certain that this scene, this protest, was going to be in some ways a culmination for my characters, especially for Yale, my main character, who's a very timid person. I needed to get him to the point where he would join this protest and be out there in the street. At the same time, I'm rewriting history in many ways because although I wanted to write very much about real events, I didn't want to write about real people. For one thing, I reinvented the gay press scene in Chicago. I made different newspapers because I needed to have an editor. I couldn't have it be that actual person. I also reinvented the ACT UP leaders, and I put some other people in there. But there is a point where my characters look up, and 5 men have come out onto the ledge outside a window of the county building right in downtown Chicago and take off their Oxford shirts to reveal ACT UP t-shirts, and they unfurl this banner that says, "We demand equal health care now." Mm. And then one by one, they're violently dragged back into the building. Yeah. This was something I was watching on YouTube. It's something that I heard about from a lot of people firsthand. And towards the end of my research, I actually got to meet one of the surviving men who was out there on the ledge, this activist named Bill McMillan, who was diagnosed very early and is still with us. And I felt like I was meeting people who'd stepped out of the Revolutionary War. You know, I felt like I'd been reading about these people studying them as heroes, as war heroes in my mind. Mm. And one of them sitting across from me now in a restaurant showing me his scrapbook.
You mentioned war. There's another storyline here. Yale, one of your characters, works for a Chicago museum. He acquires paintings and he's working on a donation from an elderly woman. She's personally picked him. And we slowly realize why. It's because this was art that she collected of many of the men she loved, artists who were killed either by World War I or the 1918 flu epidemic, which killed between 20 and 40 million people. And the parallel is so obvious.
Yeah, that was really where I started the book, was with the parallels between those two generations, these decimated generations. In America, we think a lot about the writers, the lost generation who went there after the war. But before World War I, you have visual artists coming there from all over Europe, Soutine, Modigliani, Fujita. They've all arrived in Paris as this refuge where they're going to learn art. And then the war comes and interrupts everything. Mm-hmm. And the parallels between that and the way that so many people had gotten to Chicago, they'd gotten to this place where they could be happy, where they could form a chosen family. And then this other kind of war comes through and mm-hmm. destroys so much of what they had.
Your characters have flaws. Come to find out they're human. Some of them make terrible, terrible mistakes in whether or not they want to take the test or telling themselves they're going to abstain from sexual relations and then they don't. And, you know, it's a disease in which one mistake can be a fatal mistake. But the way they wrestle over this, there's one paragraph that I think gets at the heart of it. Can you read us? Teddy's one of the characters who hasn't wanted to take the test, which, again, just came out in 1985. Given how they're viewed by society, you've got conservatives like Jesse Helms. There are people openly saying they should all die. So please, could you set that up and then read that paragraph for us?
Yes, absolutely. So Yale, my main character, has found his friend Teddy, and they're, it's immediately after the Pride Parade in 1987, and they've gone over to the park and they're in line for some food. And Teddy is a philosophy graduate student, so he tends to spout off a little bit. And this is him spouting off. "The thing is," Teddy said, "the disease itself feels like a judgment. We've all got a little Jesse Helms on our shoulder, right? If you got it from sleeping with 1,000 guys, then it's a judgment on your promiscuity. If you got it from sleeping with one guy once, that's almost worse. It's like a judgment on all of us. Like the act itself is the problem and not the number of times you did it. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, it's a judgment on your hubris. And if you got it because you knew you could and you didn't care, it's a judgment on how much you hate yourself."
What are you hearing now? You have the joke in there. If you have to tell your parents, you know, you have the virus, the trick is how do you convince them you're Haitian?
Right.
And not gay. Because there was an outbreak in Haiti, too. What are people today telling you about how that aspect of this felt?
You know, I found myself in many cases sort of playing psychiatrist to the people I was talking to. I was often asking them questions like, why do you think you're still here? And no one's answer was ever medical. Everyone's answer had something to do with God, luck, family, you know, psychology, something like that. No one ever said, well, I've always had a really strong immune system. And I think it's the kind of brutal randomness that makes you think in terms of fate and in terms of guilt and the survivor's guilt that anyone still alive with HIV is burdened with. You know, I was hearing stories of people who, before the test, were certain that they had it and never even had it. Mm-hmm. Then the people who had the virus and made their wills, said goodbye to everyone, got ready, and they're still here. Then the people who didn't make it, who I couldn't interview, you know, what might have gone through their mind. And at a time when so many people in the world were so eager to jump in and tell them it was their fault. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about very vulnerable people in so many cases who are primed, maybe unfortunately, to believe that.
Well, but you're talking now about carrying someone else's story into this, you know, fiction book. And you said at one point, "This project was undertaken with a great deal of ongoing thought and conversation and concern about the line between allyship and appropriation."
Yeah. You know, I'm a straight woman, and I'm writing about things I wasn't there for. But I felt like to do this, I needed to answer two questions for myself. And the first was, can I do this well? That's not for me to answer, but I felt like my answer to myself was, I think I can do it well if I research enough. And the second question was, is this stealing a voice from anyone in this community who would want to publish this kind of narrative, or do I have the opportunity with this to amplify those voices? And ultimately, my answer to that, the way publishing works, the more successful my book is, the more likely a publisher is to throw money behind a similar book in the future. And as I go around and talk about my book, I have the chance to recommend other narratives, first-person accounts, nonfiction books, as well as talking about the actual history of what happened. So there might be people who feel like they would not want a narrative coming from someone who wasn't there. But for people who are interested in a fictional account, I've done my best.
Rebecca Mackay, the book is The Great Believers, a novel. It's just terrific. We'll have an excerpt at herenow.org. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Mackay speaking with us about her novel, The Great Believers, back in June.